The Individual and the Established Order was presented by Earl Craig on April 15, 2007, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2007. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We have the privilege this morning to have a friend of mine, Earl Craig from Newport Beach, Southern California. He is going to come and speak to us this morning. We're going to depart from our normal procedure of actually going to the Bible for a message. Earl doesn't normally do this either, but he has recently resigned as a pastor of a church in Southern California, and the decision that he has made to resign is accompanied by a lot of reflection on the nature of the church and the dynamics of churches and that sort of thing. He's found some interesting help in Soren Kierkegaard in his book Practice Christianity. So our text this morning is going to be Kierkegaard 1:1.
I'm so used to bringing up a Bible when I teach, I just couldn't help but at least have it up here, even though I'm probably not going to refer to it directly. Good morning. It's always a privilege to be with you. It's even more of a privilege to speak to you about Christianity. As Jack mentioned, back in December, I resigned from a church where I'd been on leadership and a pastor for 21 years. And the reason was because over the course of those 21 years, every once in a while, I would challenge the traditional doctrines and the traditional practices that we held at that church. And it eventually became clear to me that my doing so was making the rest of the leadership so uncomfortable that it really would be best for me and for my family to resign from the church, and it also would be best for the church itself as well as for the leadership. Subsequently, I also found my experience was that I was ostracized from the church and from that community. And as I began to process the loss of 21 years of relationships and 21 years of a job and 21 years, quite frankly, of respect, I sought help in various texts. And obviously the most important text in which I found help was the Bible itself. But then on the recommendation of friends, I found some other books that were very helpful. For example, Thomas Kuhn's book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, and where he discusses the inertia of groups that have difficulty shifting paradigms. And that's basically what I was recommending or encouraging at times during my tenure there at the church over the 21 years was the shift, even oh so slightly, in our paradigm that was resisted by the leadership and by the rest of the church. So that book was helpful. I also found help in a book entitled The Social Construction of Reality by Peter Berger and Thomas Luckman, and I might even get a chance to quote from it this morning too, where those gentlemen talk about the taken for granted, they call them, in a social group. And again, how difficult it is when someone comes along and suggests that maybe the taken for granted should not be taken for granted, but there ought to be a change in those. And then another book that I have found encouragement in is a new author, an author, René Girard, who's a Frenchman. And he discusses the idea of scapegoating. And that's something that I can say that I think that I have experienced. I'm still processing what he's trying to say. His ideas are very new to me. But honestly, it has felt as though I was lynched by a mob, to put it in Girard's terms. And so looking at that idea has been helpful to me too. And then finally, Kierkegaard has also been helpful to me, and specifically the passage in Practicing Christianity that I want to look at this morning with you, where Kierkegaard is talking about what I would call sort of the social dynamics in a Christian setting. Christian groups always have to deal with individual Christians. And, for example, Reformation Fellowship is a Christian group. And so as a group, you're dealing with individual Christians in this group. But then the reverse is also true, that individual Christians are always dealing with a Christian group. So each one of you is dealing with Reformation Fellowship as a group, broadly speaking. And the relationships between Christian groups and individual Christians, I've discovered, is quite dicey. It's not always an easy thing to balance what it means for a Christian group to be such, biblically speaking, and for individual Christians to be such, individually speaking. And that's what Kierkegaard is dealing with in the passage that you have hopefully in front of you. So what I'm going to do this morning is simply read through this passage of Kierkegaard. He is commenting on a biblical passage, which you'll find begun at the beginning, at the bottom of that very first page, Matthew 15, 1 through 12. So what I would like to do is to comment on Kierkegaard's comments on Matthew 15 and occasionally relate them to myself as well as to you, so that we all can learn together from the biblical passage and from Kierkegaard in regard to this whole issue of a Christian group relating to individual Christians and vice versa, so that we can gain some more wisdom about how to do that wisely. So I'm going to read and just be commenting along the way, and hopefully within a relatively short amount of time, I'll get all the way through to page 92. I'm not going to read the entire text, so we'll skip occasionally, but I'll let you know when we do that. So listen to Kierkegaard first here before he provides us with the passage from Matthew 15. He starts off, "The possibility of offense." Now, let me just stop there. Going to need to lay some groundwork here, okay? Some important words. The very word offense there, I think what he means by that is to be turned off, to use a more common term for ours, and specifically to be turned off by Christ and to turn away for Christ, from Christ, wanting nothing to do with him. The Greek word is the word that he's referring to in the biblical passage, is the word from which we get our word scandal. So it's the idea of being scandalized by Christ. It's kind of like, ew, you know, if you were to come in contact with him. No, I don't want anything to do with him. And so you turn away from him and you reject him for whatever reason. And the possibility of offense is the fact that each one of us as human beings individually, there's always the possibility that we might go, ooh, when we interact with Christ, versus believing what he has to say, versus interacting with him, versus embracing him and his message. So the possibility of that then is not related to Christ as Christ, the God-man. What he's talking about here is what Kierkegaard calls the essential offense. What is the basic thing about Jesus that we would go, ew, to, is that he is Christ as a man who claims to be God on the one hand. On the other hand, he is God who becomes a man and suffers. Those two things constitute for Kierkegaard, in his opinion, the essential offense. So he's saying we're basically not talking about that here. But instead, to him simply as an individual human being. That is, just as any individual human being. It could be you. It could be me that we're talking about. We don't have to be talking about the God-man, Jesus. So just any human being is what we're talking of, is what he's talking about here. Who comes into collision with an established order. So this would be an individual who collides, runs up against the wall and finds himself face planted as he collides with what Kierkegaard calls here the established order. In Kierkegaard's day, in 19th century Denmark, the established order was the state church. It was the Lutheran church that was organized, administrated, run by the Denmark government, to the extent that the pastors of those churches were paid by the government. Other kinds of established orders, though, would be any sort of church institution. Take, for example, the Roman Catholic Church. That is an established order, I think, according to Kierkegaard's definitions. Another would be a Protestant denomination, would be an established order. Or, for that matter, a non-denominational church organization, such as the one that I was a part of for 21 years, or, for that matter, Reformation Fellowship. Any kind of Christian group where there is organized structure, and where there might be also, and especially this, traditional doctrines and practices. So Kierkegaard then is going to comment on what happens when any individual human being collides with an organized structure, Christian group, that has traditional doctrines and practices. So let's listen to him as he comments on that then. The offense under discussion here is one of which anyone, for that matter, can be the object if he, the single individual, seems to be unwilling to subject or subordinate himself to the established order. So any individual, the terminology that was used to refer to me was, I wasn't a team player, that I wasn't willing to go along with the program that had been established as traditional in the church where I was even one of the leaders. So Kierkegaard is talking about that kind of person, like me, or like you, if you've had this sort of experience too. Going on, but because an individual is unwilling to do so, it does not follow that this individual says of himself that he is God. In other words, we don't have to be talking about Jesus here, who is both the God-man. We can be talking about any individual, someone like you or me. But it is easy to perceive that here there is a magnitude tending toward being more than human. And it is this to which the established order is attentive. It's this phrase, tending toward being more than human, where an individual human being would come across to an institutional church, an organized, structured Christian group, as perhaps sounding arrogant. You'll see what he says here, more about that as we go on. Is the single individual higher than the established order? That is, does this single individual somehow perceive himself as being above the organized church, the Christian group itself? With this question, or more correctly, with this protest, the established order wants to force him either to come back again or to state categorically that he is more than human, and then the offense is present. In other words, with this question, do you think that you know better than we know, that you as an individual know better than we, the leadership of this particular church or a Christian organization or a Christian institution? Do you think that's the case? With that question, the Christian organization is saying, we want you to submit to us. We want you to conform, to stay within the boundaries of the traditional doctrines and the traditional practices. See, here is our doctrinal statement. You must stay within the bounds of this doctrinal statement. Or here are our traditional practices. We always do communion once a week. So for you to suggest that that's not necessary, that maybe we don't even need to do communion at all, well, you are placing yourself above us, above the church institution. And if that's the case, then the offense has begun. Jesus certainly could do that just simply by saying, I'm the God-man. But any individual who challenges traditional doctrines and traditional practices could do what Jesus did just by suggesting that maybe those traditions aren't entirely biblically accurate or correct. Now Kierkegaard goes on then to quote the passage that he's thinking of here, Matthew 15:1-12. Then scribes and Pharisees, these were the religious heavies of Jesus' day, and they were self-appointed religious heavies. The same way that in probably most churches, certainly non-denominational churches, even in our own country, the leadership are typically self-appointed. They're the heavies in that church. So then scribes and Pharisees came to Jesus from Jerusalem. Notice we're talking about long-distance critics here. They had traveled up to Galilee. And in my case, that's been true too, that the church has solicited help from as far away as Florida and Ohio and Texas and even Japan to deal with me as I continue to challenge traditional practices and doctrines. So even long-distance critics are sometimes asked to get involved and said, why do your disciples transgress the tradition of the elders? The traditions of the elders would have been man-made prescriptions or commandments or man-made rules for how the people should act in their relationship with God in Jesus' day. They do not wash their hands when they eat. But Jesus answered and said to them, and why do you transgress the commandment of God for the sake of your tradition? So Jesus juxtaposes God's commandments with human rules that have crept into this particular established order of Judaism in his day, where he's implying that the human rules and practices are now considered more important than God's rules and practices. For God has commanded, verse 4 here, saying, honor your father and mother, and whosoever curses father and mother shall surely die. But you say, whosoever says to his father or mother, that whereby I could have helped you is a gift, does not need to honor his father or his mother. Thus, for the sake of your tradition, you have annihilated the command of God. I won't get into detail what he's getting at here, or talking about the commandment of honor your father and mother, but basically I think what Jesus is saying is, you have replaced loving one another with making sure each of you practices the traditional practices and doctrines of your church institution. And he says, by doing so then, you have annihilated the command of God. Some English translations translate this word as made void or invalidated. I would translate it as blown to smithereens. You have blown to smithereens the commandment of God by placing so much focus and attention and importance on your own man-made rules. Verse 7, you hypocrites, justly did Isaiah prophesy of you when he said, this people keeps close to me with their mouths and honors me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. So these are people in Jesus' day who say all the right things, but where the rightness really needs to be, Jesus is saying, is internally, in their hearts. And we'll come back to this in a minute. Verse 9, but in vain do they worship me, when they teach such doctrines that are the commands of men. Pretty self-explanatory there. And he called the people to him and said to them, listen and understand, not that which goes into the mouth, perhaps even doctrinal ideas that go into one's mind, makes a person unclean, but that which comes out of the mouth, what Kierkegaard likes to talk about in other places as the desire and the commitment to embrace truth, this makes a person unclean if one doesn't have the proper desire and a willingness to commit to embracing the truth. Verse 12, then the disciples came up and said to him, do you know that the religious heavies of our day were offended when they heard this saying? So now Kierkegaard goes on to comment some more. It is self-evident, Kierkegaard says, that Christ is always the God-man. This is Kierkegaard's essential offense. It's always self-evident that Jesus is going to offend people because he claims to be the God-man who suffers on our behalf for the sake of our sins and for the sake of our salvation. But here, after all, is a historical situation, one that any of us could be a part of as a human being. And the offense mentioned here pertains not to the God-man, neither because he, as an individual human being, claims to be God, or because he, who is God, is this lowly human being. So the offense is not because of Jesus being the God-man. But instead, here, Christ is in the more ordinary sense a teacher, like me, now, or you, anytime any of us is talking about Christianity with another human being. A teacher of godliness, he goes on to say, of inwardness, who with originality, without any question here of his claim to be God, emphasizes inwardness in contrast to empty outwardness. So, in the text above, sorry, let me finish this sentence. A teacher who transforms outwardness into inwardness. So in the text that we read above, Jesus was emphasizing the heart above the empty outwardness of washing hands before one eats. There's lots that I could say that we could talk about in terms of inwardness as Kierkegaard understands it and as we ought to understand it from a biblical perspective. But let me just mention three things that have been part of my own experience, hopefully to help you that you can relate to. A few of us have been studying 1 John in a Bible study. And the first aspect of inwardness is one that I think is very clear in 1 John, where John is describing the radical difference between God and man. And that radical difference shows up in our own individual human Christian lives as the recognition for us of what I call the depth of sin, in contrast to recognizing what I call the height of God's grace. And the important thing is to retain the tension that exists between those two. The depth of my sin is so deep that there is nothing but nothing that I can do to rescue myself from God's justice and from his wrath. And so what I need, therefore, is the height of God's grace to initiate towards me, to change my heart so that I become someone who believes the truth of the gospel and embraces that truth. But God's grace is something that is completely out of my control. And it seems more often than not, my sin is also something that seems to be completely out of my control, at least to the extent that I am always aware that my sin is there. And so there is this tension that needs to exist in our lives that we consciously, even emotionally, feel between our sin and God's grace. And doing so, feeling that tension, that's part of the inwardness that I think Jesus would describe and that Kierkegaard is getting at too. A second aspect of inwardness, though, is where we allow for process in learning biblical truth and allowing challenges to traditional doctrines and practices, that we don't require that people believe everything that ought to be believed or is true about Christianity now, but realize that none of us believes all that Christianity offers to us, the Bible offers to us, even understands it accurately or completely now. And so allowing each other to be in the process of coming to that an understanding of biblical truth, watching one another in the midst of our desire to pursue that truth, that too is an important aspect of inwardness, as opposed to the empty outwardness, which is just simply to hold up our doctrinal statement and say, see, this is all that the Bible is saying. Believe it right now or else. And then a third aspect of inwardness that I'd want to mention is where we would allow people to say, we don't have to do things that way, really. But that's the way we've always done things at Reformation Fellowship. That's the way we've always done things within the Roman Catholic Church. That's the way we've always done things within the state church here in Denmark. Well, maybe we don't have to do things that way. No. But that's something that we need to allow people to say, that I would suggest is an important part of inwardness. We'll come back to all this. Let's keep going, though. So back to about the middle of the page there. This is the collision, a collision that appears again and again in Christendom, that is, in church history with traditions, where these individuals with inwardness challenge the empty externalities or outwardness of the traditional churches. To put it briefly, it is the collision of pietism with the established order. And here, Kierkegaard is using the word pietism to refer to authentic Christianity, where there is this inwardness. The Pharisees and scribes are namely representatives of the established order, which precisely because of their quibbling and shrewdness has become an empty indeed or ungodly externality. The Pharisees are raising an objection to something that is trivial. Washing your hands before you eat, they've made that a rule, a religious rule that ingratiates you to God, that pleases God. And Kierkegaard is saying, that's so trivial that it's hardly worth talking about, and yet that is what they challenge Jesus on. We keep going. The established order, whether Judaism or any other church institution, however, at that time, now Judaism obviously, insisted and always insisted on being the objective higher than each and every individual, than subjectivity. So the established order insisted upon being above and was saying to the individuals, submit to us or else. The moment when an individual is unwilling to subordinate himself or submit himself to this established order, or indeed even questions its being true, yes, charges it with being untruth, that is, declares that they're actually missing the truth. Whereas he declares that he himself is in the truth and of the truth by declaring that they're missing the truth, I'm saying, declares that the truth lies specifically in inwardness. And there is the collision, whether the three aspects that I mentioned to you or any others that would be included in this idea of inwardness. Quite properly, the established order poses the question, who does this individual think he is? Does he perhaps think that he is God? Which Jesus could answer, yes. Or that he has an immediate relation to God? Which any of us, as authentic Christians, can claim, yes. Or at least that he is more than a human being, Now, that's the way this individual appears to the established order. You're coming across to us rather arrogantly right now by challenging us in our traditional practices and doctrines. So are you making yourself out to be more than human, different from the crowd here in our particular established order and institution? Are you saying you're different and that by your difference, it's okay to be different? What we need to recognize is that we as human beings naturally gravitate towards homogeneity. Intellectually, emotionally, psychologically, spiritually. But allowing for process is vital to authentic Christianity, so that we allow people to be different and even engage in different practices, and certainly to be different in maybe even what they believe while they're pursuing coming to a more accurate understanding of the biblical message. Well, now I want to skip over to page 87. About the middle of the page, you'll see on the very left-hand side the two words "every time." All right? Middle of the page there, page 87. Every time a witness to the truth transforms truth into inwardness, and this is the essential activity of the witness to the truth. Every time a genius internalizes the true in an original way, then the established order will in fact be offended at him. Can you hear Kierkegaard's sarcasm here? Every time a genius internalizes the true in an original way. I don't think Kierkegaard was really bright, but I think that he's being sarcastic here. It doesn't take a genius to be able to perceive when an established order has gone astray. And it doesn't take a genius to understand authentic Christianity and the true inwardness of authentic Christianity. In Berger and Luckman's book, The Social Construction of Reality, in a discussion about the medieval church and how the medieval church was dealing with people who challenged the taken-for-granteds of the medieval church, and take, for example, Luther or Calvin or Zwingli during the Protestant Reformation. And Berger and Luckman are identifying men like that as intellectuals. But they say this about the intellectual, the genius. The intellectual is thus, by definition, a marginal type. Whether he was first marginal and then became an intellectual, as, for example, in the case of many Jewish intellectuals in the modern West, or whether his marginality was a direct result of his intellectual aberrations, the case of the ostracized heretic, need not concern us here. In either case, his social marginality expresses his lack of theoretical integration within the universe of his society. He appears as the counter-expert in the business of defining reality. Like the official expert, the one who is embraced by the group, he has a design for society at large, or let's say for a church institution. But while the former's design is in tune with, that is the official expert, with the institutional programs, serving as their theoretical legitimation, the intellectuals exist in an institutional vacuum, socially objectivated at best in the sub-society of fellow intellectuals. A lot of highfalutin language there, isn't there? Let me see if I can boil it down for you. The accepted experts in any institution are those who are going along with the program. But then someone comes along who perhaps points out an anomaly, to put it in Kuhn's term, in the structure of scientific revolutions, and suggests maybe an alternative way to understand that anomaly. And that person is then ostracized because he's coming across as an intellectual who is not following the program. Well, going back to Kierkegaard here, that's the same thing I think he's saying about this genius who internalizes the true in an original way. But what I would suggest to you is that each and every one of you here at Reformation Fellowship is a genius. That's why he's using this term sarcastically. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to be able to understand and articulate authentic Christianity. And so any one of you could stand up and challenge how we do things here at Reformation Fellowship. Almost said where I used to be. Or what we believe here. And ought to be granted that freedom to do so as we observe your heart as a heart that is sincerely seeking to learn and embrace biblical truth. In the next paragraph, Kierkegaard says some things about Hegel that I have no idea what he's talking about, and David and Jack were helpful yesterday at a conference I went to where they made some comments. But to summarize, what he says here is that what ends up happening to the so-called established order is that it gets deified. You'll see right in the middle of that paragraph the words, he deified the established order. The deification of the established order is when the established order implicitly proclaims that it is God. A church implicitly proclaims, we have the truth and all the truth and nothing but the truth, so help us, God. And so you must submit to us and to our truth. Because it's always, at least subconsciously, claiming it is right, this established order or institution, whichever it might be. Now on to page 88. The first full paragraph that begins with, but. But that. The established order has become something divine. So this is the deification of the established order. But that the, or let's just call it traditional institution, has become something divine, is regarded as the divine, is a falsehood brought about by ignoring its own origin. When a commoner has become a nobleman, he usually makes every possible effort to have his earlier life, we won't read the Latin there, forgotten. So also with the established order. The established order also began with that collision between the single individual and the established order. And so, I'm sorry, began with a collision between the single individual and the established order. Began with the single individual's relationship with God. But now that is to be forgotten, the bridge cut down, and the established order deified. Love to talk a lot more about this. Every good church always begins with some individual who recognizing something important about the important inwardness of Christianity and says, the church that I'm attending right now is not inward enough. And so let's start a new church. And that church is going to be a pure church, so to speak, because we're going to be able to live out authentic Christianity as it ought to be lived, because we're going to focus on the heart and on the inwardness of Christianity. But eventually what happens is every good church ends up becoming a bad church, is what Kierkegaard claims here. Every good institution, church institution, ends up becoming a bad traditional institution because it forgets its origin. It forgets what really made it a good church or a good church institution, a good denomination even, in the very beginning. And this happens generation after generation, century after century, down through Christendom, down through church history. A little story that reminded me of this, and it doesn't entirely relate, but I wanted to tell you the story anyway, because it was a really remarkable experience that I had a few weeks ago. One of my older son's best friends is Kelsey Peterson, in fact, Lieutenant Kelsey Peterson. Graduate of Annapolis and a Navy SEAL. And he and his SEAL team, in fact, are leaving for Iraq tomorrow, on Monday. But he wanted to marry his fiancée before he left, Caitlin. And they asked me to officiate at the ceremony, and so I did. So I was down in San Diego, there at the Naval Base, overlooking San Diego Bay, beautiful, boring Southern California, sunny day, and with the downtown San Diego behind me and overlooking the bay and the USS Nimitz that was tied up at dock there on the island across from us. And whenever a couple who are getting married choose the traditional vows, I always like to mention to them that those vows were written by Thomas Cranmer, who was the Archbishop of Canterbury during the reign of Henry VIII as well, and he wrote those words, those sort of immortal words, during the reign of Edward VI, around 1540. Just to remind the couple that there's a long tradition to the words that they are about to repeat to themselves. You know, I, Kelsey, take you, Caitlin, to be my lawful wedded wife, to have and to hold, etc., etc. Those words were written by Thomas Cranmer, part of the English Book of Common Prayer. Well, after the ceremony, we were inside having lunch at the reception, and a young man in civilian clothes walks up to me, and he says, excuse me, sir, I just want to tell you that I really enjoyed that service, and my name is Thomas Cranmer. And it was rather noisy in the reception area, so I wasn't sure I quite heard him. And I said, excuse me? What is your name? And I had to ask him even a second time. Okay, one more time. Give it to me. Thomas Cranmer. And I said, are you a descendant of the Thomas Cranmer? He said, yes, sir, I am. I said, well, can I ask you, when did your family come over to this country? And he said, oh, on about the third boat. Somewhere in the late 1600s. And I told him, I said, well, Thomas, you have made my day. I've never met a descendant of Thomas Cranmer, one of my heroes, one of the three of the so-called Oxford martyrs. He was burned at the stake for his inwardness, quite frankly, as he proclaimed Protestantism there during the reign of Queen Mary. But he was in civilian clothes, but I just want to let you all also know, too, he is part of Kelsey's SEAL team. So he heads for Iraq tomorrow. So if you have it in mind as you pray for our military in Iraq, be praying maybe not only for my friend Kelsey, but also you can be praying for Thomas Cranmer, who will be on his way tomorrow. Well, that's just to help show us that down through the years, individuals have stood up and challenged traditional doctrines and practices as this young man's, I don't know, great-great-great-great-great-grandfather did, and paid the price for it because institutions forget their origins. Going on then. Strangely enough, this deification of the established order is the perpetual revolt, the continual mutiny against God. This is rough language here. He's saying that traditional institutions are actually rebelling against God, not worshiping God. That is, listen to the sarcasm here. That is, God wants to be involved, and one can scarcely blame him for that. Wants to have a little bit of control of the world's development, or he wants to keep the human race developing. We'll see more of this idea of process that he's going to talk about in a moment. The deification of the established order, however, is the smug invention of the lazy, secular human mentality that wants to settle down and fancy that now there is total peace and security. Now we have achieved the highest. So here what Kierkegaard is talking about is where a Christian group, church institution, has eliminated the tension between the depth of my evil and sin within me and the height of God's grace, and eliminated that tension through liturgious living, let's call it, through telling people this is how you live the Christian life, three steps to, for example, the victorious Christian life, or just three steps to how we do Christianity in our church. Now, what's interesting, of course, is that because God's grace is so high, God could make us morally perfect right now by his grace. He could do that. Or on the other hand, I could live a life of total heinous evil. So this tension is between two ends of a spectrum. I could either go towards evil, or God theoretically could make me a morally perfect human being. But the fact of the matter is, I'm caught in between those as a Christian. And there is the tension. I am what some author is called a righteous sinner. It's escaping me right now, sorry. But what it's important for us as Christians to realize is that sin contaminates our righteousness, and our righteousness contaminates our sin. I can be in the midst of handing a glass of water to a thirsty person with the most noble motivation and intention as an authentic Christian, and yet my sin is contaminating that act. Somewhere deep within me is still my pride, still my sense that I'm going to pat myself on the back for doing this. I don't feel as like that right now, but it's there. And I could be in the midst of the most heinous evil of murder, of adultery, of stealing, of lying, of deception, as an authentic Christian. And in the midst of that most heinous sin, righteousness is contaminating that sin. Because still at the core of my being, grace is at work because God has changed my heart and I am an authentic Christian. So I'm caught in this in-betweenness, this side of eternity. And what the established order constantly tries to do is to eliminate that tension, to get us uncaught, to convince us there's a way that we can always be good, that we can live the victorious Christian life, for example. So going on then, back up into this paragraph, and then along comes a singular one, a Mr. Impudence, a Mr. Disrespectful towards the church institution, the traditions of the church, who fancies himself as being higher than the established order. But no, this is not to say that he is self-deluded. It could be very well that he is the gadfly, the established order needed to keep it from falling asleep or from falling into what is even worse, self-deification. Gadfly simply means someone who provokes others into action by criticism. A Socrates, for example, or all of us, for that matter, intended by God to help each other out of our sleep, where we might tend towards becoming comfortable simply in our traditions. Every human being, Kierkegaard goes on, is to live in fear and trembling, and likewise no established order is to be exempted from fear and trembling. So he's saying if a church institution is operating correctly, it is as a group sensing living Christianity with as much fear and trembling as each individual in that group. Because that's where it begins, with each one of us facing into the tension between the depth of our sin and the height of grace, of the grace of God, and allowing that to be there and living in fear and trembling of God. Well, then collectively, the whole church will be one of fear and trembling too. Fear and trembling signify that we are in the process, see that word again, of becoming. And every single individual, likewise the generation, is and should be aware of being in process of becoming. And fear and trembling signify that there is a God, something every human being and every established order ought not to forget for a moment. So we're in the process of becoming. We're heading towards the elimination of that tension between our sin and God's moral perfection and His grace. We're heading towards that, but we're never arriving this side of eternity. Top of page 89. Thus, Judaism, at the time of Christ, became, through the scribes and Pharisees, the heavies of His day, a complacent or content, self-deifying established order. The outer and the inner had become entirely commensurable, so totally that the inner had dropped out. External practices and behavior had become equal to internal attitudes or the state of one's heart in the Judaism of Jesus' day. But when that happens, when the outward becomes as important as the inward, Kierkegaard is claiming, the inward drops out. That is, it loses its place in people's minds as being the most important. This commensurability, this equality, we could say, or congruity, are sure indications that an established order is in the process of deifying itself. Everything that could remind one of the contending truth is abolished as something now regarded as not far from ridiculous. Now truth is victorious. The truth that once was contending is now the established order. The contending truth here is the truth that argues against settling down into traditions. The biblical truth, the message that Jesus brought, that's that truth. Going on, to be in the truth can no longer mean to have to suffer. This is a key element of Kierkegaard and his writings. None of us wants to suffer. There is a way to keep from suffering within the church. And that is, make the church define it simply by traditional practices and doctrines. Then we all can just behave the same way, dress the same way, act the same way, believe the same way, sing the same way, do everything that we would do to define Christianity, and nobody's going to rock the boat. Nobody's going to upset anyone else because there's this homogeneity that we have created within our own church. And the more one is in the truth, the more suffering. No, here there is congruity or equality or going alongness. The more one is of the truth, quote unquote here though, the more honored and esteemed one becomes. And we see this happen in churches. I'll come back to this in a second. And now everything is as it should be. Now the established order is deified. If Christ came into the world now, he would first become a professor. In our day, he'd become a senior pastor and would steadily advance, all according as it became more apparent that he was in the truth, quote unquote. Over to page 90. Middle of the page, the quote that begins why. The why is over near the right-hand side of the page there. Why, says the established order to the single individual, do you want to torture and torment yourself with the enormous criterion of ideality? Why do you insist upon always going back to Jesus' message, where he insists on our pursuing righteousness, where we'd have to recognize that we can't eliminate the tension within us between the depth of our sin and the height of God's grace? Instead, the established order says this: turn to the established order. Join the established order. Here is the criterion. If you're a student, then you can be sure that the professor is the criterion and the truth. If you're a clergyman, then the bishop is the way and the life. If you're a clerk, then the counselor of justice is the goal. Nothing too much. Or he could say, if you're a member, or if you're a congregant in a church, then the senior pastor is the way and the life, or the board of elders for that matter. The established order is the rational, it's the right way to think. And you are fortunate if you take the relativity assigned to you. Relativity is just simply taking less than what's really true about the gospel message itself, as Jesus has explained it to us, as well as the apostles. And for the rest, let the ministries, the council, or whatever take care of it. My eternal happiness? Well, yes, of course. And if there is really something wrong with you in this respect, if you cannot, when your time has come, be satisfied with being like all the others, just fitting in with the group, packed and wrapped to go along in one of the big consignments, this batch of people to be delivered to heaven, that the established order dispatches to eternity under its own seal and with the address Eternal Happiness, perfectly certain of being just as well received and just as blessed as all the others. In short, if you cannot let yourself be satisfied with such a reassuring security and guarantee as this, that the established order, the church traditions and doctrines vouch for your eternal happiness in the hereafter, well then, shut up. Keep it to yourself. The established order has nothing against that. You can still be a part of us. You can still do everything that we're doing. Just don't say anything. That if you keep absolutely silent about it, you will be just as well off as the others. Skip down to the next paragraph that begins, when. When an individual appeals to his relationship with God over against the established order, traditional church, what have you, that has deified itself, that has made itself the paragon of truth and reality, and or of Christianity, really, deified itself. It does indeed seem as if he were making himself more than human. But he is not doing that at all, for he admits, after all, that every human being, unconditionally every person, has and is to have for his part the same relationship with God. Each one of us has the right to our own private judgment with regard to what the truth of the Bible is. So that each one of us then needs to be people, individuals, who are pursuing that truth. I think I want to say more about this in a second, so I'll hold off here. Just as little as someone who says that he is in love thereby denies that someone else is in love, so even less does such an individual deny that the others, but as individuals, have a relationship with God. But the established, that's a difficult sentence, we'll just kind of skip over for the time being. But the established order will not put up with consisting of something as loose as a collection of millions of individuals, each of whom has his or her relationship with God. I'm trying to be politically correct here. The established order wants to be a totality that recognizes nothing above itself, but has every individual under it, and judges every individual who subordinates himself to the established order. But what he's talking about here, the established order wants to be a totality. We tend towards wanting to make our churches into Christian totalitarianism, where it's the organization that dictates exactly what everyone does and exactly what everyone believes. That's totalitarianism. But that single individual who teaches the most humbly and yet also the most human doctrine about what it means to be a human being, this sense of inwardness, of coming to grips with sin and grace, as I would describe it, the established order will intimidate by charging him with being guilty of blasphemy. It might even seek to ostracize him from the church. So also with the Pharisees who were offended at Christ, because he made piety or spirituality into absolute inwardness, not directly commensurable. That it you can't equate what's going on the inside with what's going on the outside, commensurable with the external. Rather the reverse, identifiable by suffering, being willing to suffer for the truth. And in any case, not completing itself in an outright relativity, that is, destroying the tension, as I was talking about it earlier. By making devoutness and piety, or Christianity, or spirituality, inwardness, Christ prodded, he goaded, and he criticized this whole structure of qualifications and relativities that was created by Judaism. This direct recognizability of piety by honor and esteem, power and influence, this objectivity, as the scribes and Pharisees would have called it. See what he's saying here? The same thing that we talk about when you want to know how successful your church is, or you want to know how successful somebody else's church is, ask them how many people go to that church. We always want to quantify things. Numbers, power, esteem, prestige. How many books has your senior pastor written? Well, I guess, or your senior pastors, plural here. But a few, but not as many as a lot of others. So I'm sorry, you're just not quite cutting it here at Reformation Fellowship. Or how many people go to your church? Not as many as the megachurches. This is a microchurch. This is a seeker-insensitive church. Doesn't seem to be a really seeker-sensitive church. So that's what Kierkegaard is getting at. Christ prodded the traditional, accepted, objectifiable, here's how we measure Christianity, spirituality, to look more towards inwardness as the way to define Christianity. Altogether convinced of being right, and probably assured in advance that Christ would have to lose by their killing him, the Jewish leaders posed to him the question of why his disciples transgressed the ordinances of the ancients. It is always that way when the established order has gone so far as to deify itself. Finally, custom and usage, traditional practices, traditional doctrines become articles of faith. Everything becomes equally important, or ordinances, usage, and custom become what is important. The single individual does not feel and acknowledge that he, and thus every individual, has a relationship with God that is to have absolute meaning for him. No, the relationship with God is abolished. It's blown to smithereens. Custom, ordinances, and the like are deified. But that kind of fear of God is nothing but contempt for God. Indeed, it does not fear God, it fears people. That is why Christ answers the Pharisees, "Why do you transgress God's commandments for the sake of your man-made human traditions and ordinances?" That is, the scribes and Pharisees have become so holy, and so holy do people always become when they deify the established order, that their worship makes a fool of God. Under the guise of worshiping and adoring God, I mean, they really believe they're worshiping and adoring God, and they look as though they're worshiping and adoring God, but instead they worship and adore their own invention. Either in self-complacent joy, patting themselves on the back, saying, "Wow, look what we have done," with God's help, of course, since they themselves are the inventors, or in fear of people. But as stated, the person who fails to appreciate such an established order comes to be regarded as one who makes himself more than human, and people are offended at him, even though he really is only making God, God, in himself a human being. Or to put it in words that I've used also, even though he is only making grace, grace, and evil, evil. So in conclusion, we will all tend to set the way that we do Christianity and the way that we do church to set that in concrete and resist change, thus deifying the established order of our own Christian group. But what we must do is to make inwardness primary. We must look at the depth of our sin in tension with the height of God's grace, as we also observe Jesus of Nazareth as our Messiah who suffered and died, that he might rescue us through God's mercy from God's judgment, for the promise of eternal life, as well as allowing each other to be in process, challenging the established order, permitting this to happen, and granting each other the different, the grace to be different. So I would ask you, as Reformation Fellowship, Are there ways that you're deifying this group, this institution, this organization, this structure? Even to the extent, are you making non-tradition your tradition? That's just as potential or possible a tendency on our part as human beings to avoid the truth. Are you in your own lives coming to grips with just how evil you are at the core of your being? While you're civil towards one another, while you're polite towards one another, while you're gracious towards one another, while you're good towards one another, kind and giving and generous and charitable and loving and patient, all the very things that you should be and do towards one another, but recognizing that sin will always contaminate that. But then also, if you're struggling with some sin and you think, how in the world could I call myself a Christian with this sin which seems to be so habitual in my life, I can't get rid of it, and yet I call myself a Christian. Do you recognize that just that itself, longing maybe to be good, recognizing the struggle that is within you, is righteousness contaminating your sin? God's grace at work in your own heart, in your own mind, as you continue on your own journey of learning the truth of the gospel from the scriptures and helping others to do that in process as we all are on our way to the celestial city in eternal life. I've got 3 minutes for questions. Are there any burning questions?
The question I have is why do we do this? And I'll give you my guess and you can comment. The Israelites were faced with this vision of what is heaven, and they made, or what is God, and they couldn't worship God without having a calf to represent it. And it seems that we're trying to construct this view of heaven that's impossible to do. Where once we get to heaven, and I don't truly understand what's going to happen when we're there, but there's going to be a certain amount of equality. There's going to be freedom from death and disease. There's going to be a oneness with God that we aren't even able to comprehend here on earth. So I guess, do you see us constructing these deifications of churches, this oneness, this, if we only sang this way, if we only prayed this way, if we only worshiped this way, we're trying to elevate ourselves to experience the inexperienceable. We're trying to basically achieve heaven here when we'll never actually ever be able to do that.
I would certainly see that as part of the motivation, because heaven, we've been told, is going to be a lot better than what we're experiencing now. Well, gee, why don't we just go ahead and try to create it now then? And that sounds like a plausible answer to that question too.
Thanks, Earl. So I've been in management at the local water and electric utility. I've been there for 20-something years, and so you can't really do that without being a student of organizational culture. And a lot of the things that Kierkegaard said, I think, could easily appear in a basic book on management about the nature of culture. And sometimes I find it's easier to actually infect an institution and foment change than it is in a religious or quasi-religious organization. And I think that's because, well, two reasons. One is that secular institutions tend to have stronger and more immediate feedback, because if they're working on behalf of consumers, and those consumers give them pretty immediate feedback about what they want and don't want. But in a very traditional organization like I'm in, it's always a challenge to not redefine what we're supplying in the light of our practice, but to reinterpret our practice in the light of what our mission is, our charter is. And it's the same thing for the church, is to have that ability to kind of reflect on you use the word process a lot, and I think that's totally appropriate, because we tend to think of, since truth is static, truth is stable and unchanging, then somehow we should be stable and unchanging, and it becomes part of our culture to show deference and not question. Mm-hmm. And my last observation is around the word genius, and I'm not sure you meant it sarcastically. I think in the etymology of the word, it's just something genuine, something unique and different from what everybody else is doing. And I think that is an attribute of humanity, one that we have difficulty celebrating, particularly in the church, but even in secular society, to celebrate the differing minority opinion, particularly when it's about ourselves and about our culture that we've embraced so much.
Good.
So anyway, very timely. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for offering that. Maybe one more.
First, I really appreciate your teaching this morning, and particularly with the point that you made about our sin contaminating any righteousness that we might have, or our righteousness contaminating any sin. That was really appreciated. And I know that individual thinking is not traditionally encouraged in, and as the young man was saying, in most groups, and particularly the church. And in some ways that has been a defense of the church in terms of the fact that when we speak a language, we all have to understand that language can convey a truth, and that there are established truths within Christianity that are not compromised, that cannot be compromised. And so when you speak of somebody coming along or to have patience with that person when they are identifying maybe a different truth than people have seen before, or maybe a different way of looking at it and being patient with that, I agree with that. And I'm wondering also what the church's proper response should be when it is clearly coming against that which is what we have understood as a Christian culture, and from the truth from the beginning, you know, Jesus as the Messiah and the person, the third person of the Godhead. You know, what is the church's proper response when someone is going off in a direction that really doesn't look right?
I think to comment on that and to address that and to confront that with grace, in humility, in patience, and encouragement towards looking at the scriptures and learning the truth of the scriptures and allowing the scriptures, the Bible itself, to be our sole authority. I think that would be a proper response. Well, thank you all. But may I pray before we, as we end here? Our gracious and almighty God, we thank you for the source of our truth, and that is the scriptures. And what they teach us about you as our creator, sovereign, our ruler, our king, our authority. Thank you for what they teach us about ourselves, as offensive as the message is, and that we want to go, ooh, I don't want to hear about my sin. And yet, we thank you that you are a gracious God, and the scriptures teach us about your grace, as you change us into people who face squarely into our sin, and then also on our knees, beating our breasts as a tax collector in the temple, crying out to you, God, be merciful to me, the sinner. And we face into your incredible love, that through our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, the God-man, who suffered on our behalf, who died the death that we deserve, that we obtain your mercy as he offers himself to you, rather than our having to offer ourselves to you and only being punished for it. So God, we do thank you for us as a group, a Christian group, but may we be a Christian group who acknowledges the individuals, and may we be individuals who acknowledge the Christian group and live in healthy relationship one to the other and with each other. For we thank you, for in Jesus' name, Amen.